You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Thursday, November 9th, Mike McNamara with you. Approaching hour two of All Marine Radio. And what you're going to hear is an interview that, I'll tell you what, I wanted to have Colonel Barnum on, Barney Barnum, who I was introduced to by Bob Nelson. And so I wanted to have him on, I don't know, a month or two ago. So I contacted him and we set it up and I put it in my calendar and I put it in the wrong year. And I don't know. I don't even know how I did it, right? You have to be gifted to do that. So I don't know. I was clicking around somehow and I put it in the wrong year. So, you book guests every day for this kind of stuff, right? So I don't pay too much attention. And all of a sudden at the most recent Medal of Honor ceremony, I have it on a monitor here with no sound as I do the show in case there is breaking news. So, I glance over because there's these guys in uniform in the White House and a Medal of Honor ceremony, and I see Colonel Barnum there. And I think, oh my God, what happened? He was supposed to be on the show. So I start looking around like, what happened? And, I find the email exchange, so I go to the calendar and I look and it's not there. And then I just start looking and I see it a year later. So I sent him an email apologizing because he must think I'm an idiot, right? I said, hey, whenever you can come back on. So he said, he gave me some dates, so we did it. But he is, for those of you who don't know him, he had very, very interesting story. I would tell you, if you haven't heard the first interview we did with him, by all means, go on the All Marine Radio podcast page, Barnum. Barnum, and you can throw Barney in there, and you'll find it too. So he tells the story of being an artillery officer. He's from Connecticut, and he joins the Marine Corps. He was a member of the Boy Scouts. And a bit of a leader, an athlete, growing up. He's a pretty typical young guy, right? Raised by World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, coached by them, all of that. So he's at barracks duty in Hawaii, right? He gets out of the basic school. He joins Alpha Battery, 1st Battalion, 12th Marines in Okinawa. And, it does normal stuff. Not in Vietnam. It's in Okinawa. He gets promoted to 1st Lieutenant. Then he gets transferred to the 2nd Marine Air Wing. And he's working for them as a personal affairs officer in the Career Advisory Office, whatever the hell that was. All right. He detaches from after doing that for about a year, and he goes to be a guard officer at Pearl Harbor, at the Marine Barracks at Pearl Harbor. So they get together as officers and staff NCOs, and they say, with this Vietnam thing going, there's going to be our guys going. Somebody, we should start sending, see if we can rotate guys over there, and then come back and help train Marines and, tell them what's going on and whatnot. And so he sees the barrack CO, and he says, you know, I'm not married. I probably should be the first guy to go, you know. So they say, okay, now he's supposed to go there. I want to say he was supposed to go there for less than 90 days. So on his first patrol with, I want to say, India 3-4, he's just walking along as a forward observer for the company. And it is the action where, you know, that leads to his Medal of Honor. Yeah, First Lieutenant Barnum. In the first volley of fire, the company commander was killed, and the radio operator was wounded. He runs out and retrieves both bodies under fire, and he fights the company for the next I don't know how many days. And so he's nominated and he's awarded the Medal of Honor. So his he's got two Bronze Stars. He's got a Purple Heart and a Medal of Honor. So, he is a down to earth, straight talking, make no bones about it, Marine. Awesome, awesome, awesome guy. Again, what I love about my job is I get a chance to cross paths with him. And when you hear him tell stories of being around General Davis, you know, Ray Davis, you know. You read his awards and what he did in World War II in Korea, and your jaw hits the ground. Let me just read you General Davis's awards, and I won't read you all of them. Okay, Medal of Honor. Navy Cross, Distinguished Service Medal times 2, Silver Star times 2, Legion of Merit with Combat V times 2, Bronze Star with Combat V, Purple Heart, Vietnamese Gallantry Cross times 3. that's Ray Davis, okay? So, you know, he walks in, he's a lieutenant, and these guys are general officers, and by becoming an aide, and having won the Medal of Honor, he winds up in the company of these men. Yeah. And so, I mean, and he talks about it a little bit in what you're going to hear, what it was like. But amazing. All right, Lew Walt, here's his awards. All right. Navy Cross times 2, Distinguished Service Medal times 2, Silver Star Medal, Legion of Merit with a Combat V, Bronze Star Medal with a Combat V, Purple Heart times 2, Combat Action Ribbon times 3. So these guys are in the Pantheon, and then at the time that he's in, he's in Vietnam, General Barrow is the regimental commander of 9th Marines. So let me just read you Barrow's awards. And, I mean, the way he talks about these guys tells you everything that you need to know about them. But, you know, this is like the pantheon of heroes, at least a small part of it in the Marine Corps. General Barrow, Navy Cross, Distinguished Service Cross, Distinguished Service Medal, Navy Distinguished Service Medal, Army Distinguished Service Medal, Silver Star, Legion of Merit, times 3 with Combat V, Bronze Star times 2 with Combat V, Combat Action. So these are the guys that he walks among. And the story about General Barrow as a commandant is the Marine Corps post-Vietnam he's commandant from 1979 to 1983. So just before he joined the Marine Corps. So he's the one that throws the door open and says, get out. And he says, I don't care if it's me, my driver, and a fire team. They're getting out of the Marine Corps. And talks about what a great man he was. Tells a story. So anyway, without further ado, here is just an awesome interview. and very graciously given up his time last night to talk to us here on All Marine Radio about a variety of different issues, to include hazing, the Navy, leadership, the series on Vietnam. So, with great pride, Barney Barnum gives his time to us. So, here you go. We continue here with somebody who's no stranger to the program, and joining us again is retired from the United States Marine Corps, Barney Barnum. So, Barney, first of all, thanks for doing this again. I appreciate it. The last time we did this, I got a bunch of email about your appearance, and people truly enjoyed the interviews. So thanks for coming back on.
Oh, that's good. Yep.
Good
to be able to get your Marines to respond back as we approach our 242nd birthday here.
Yeah. So on this week, first of all, happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk about the birthday. You've been affiliated with the Marine Corps for an awful long time, most of your life now. What does the Marine Corps mean to you now?
Well, the Marine Corps, that's the biggest fraternity in the world, and I'm just fortunate to be a member of it. I just cherish the people I served with, the people I got to lead, and the things I got to do for the country, and I think it makes me feel good. It makes me feel good to be an American, and of course the most important thing in my life. Not rank or position, it's the title Marine.
Are there any birthdays that you experience as you reflect that stand out more than others do?
Oh, you know, that's hard to say. I think, a couple in Vietnam stand out because, you know, we don't do much, but someone took a piece of pound cake and put a candle in it. I'm gonna be up in Naperville, Illinois for the birthday this year, and a group of Marine Corps leaguers and my radio operator, Pat Iaconato, from the battle in Vietnam where I received the medal, is gonna be there, and two of my troopers from the second tour, so I'm looking forward to that. And then I'll fly to Boston, and I'll be at the Semper Fi luncheon up there with 2,300 other Marines and the chairman, General Dunford's guest of honor. So, this is gonna be a good birthday ball.
Wow. No. The that sounds like a good one. How did you first cross paths with the chairman? And can you tell us about that? I mean, I had a chance to work with him in Iraq in 2004, and I didn't know. I had never met him. I never even heard of him. Who's Joe Dunford? And yeah. John Kelly looked at me and goes, "Matt, you're stupid. He's from Boston. You'll love him." And I said, "I hate people from Boston."
Well, I tell you, I first met Joe when I was attending. I always go up to Boston around the 10th of November and for the Semper Fidelis luncheon. And Joe has been there a number of times as the guest of honor, and his family's there. So I met him when, actually, first of all, when he was a young colonel, and met his dad and his brother and his mom. So then, of course, I, like everybody else, followed Colonel Joe Dunford's phenomenal leadership in Iraq. So I just followed him, and of course, I got to know him well, and he and his wife Ellen. I count him as a damn good friend.
Now, you know, and he is, he's a wonderful, and this sounds pretty un-Marine-like, but he's a wonderful human being. You talk about a guy who has time, takes time for everybody, to the point when you're working with him, you look at him, and I counseled him once. I said, you know, Colonel, he had been selected for Brigadier General, and he was the chief of staff of the division, and I was the staff sec. And I said, you know, Colonel, I think the corporation's got, you know, fairly big plans for you, but you're going nowhere if you can't learn a little time management. And he looked at me, and he laughed, and he said, Mac, he said, this is the way I've done it. This is the way I've always done it, and I'm not I'm not changing. And this is after this is the you know, we have Fallujah surrounded, Ramadi's going crazy, whatever's going on out at Al-Qaim, Husayba, and he's putting it all together because Madison Conway don't see eye to eye. He's the guy who goes behind the scenes and patches it all up on a nightly basis. And I mean, he's got a big job. And the chaplain came and said, sir, could I talk to you? He sat with the chaplain for 45 minutes and spoke with him in the midst of all of this. And I...
Oh, sure.
And
no,
so,
that's just, that's the way he is. And that, you said something that I take homage to, and that is, it might sound un-Marine-ish to be that way, but I think that's the epitome of a great leader. And I heard you said you were a staff sec. I was staff sec in 2nd Division back in the 70s.
Great minds. Kelly, I was working in division plans, and Mattis's aide got wounded, and they made the staff sec the aide. And Kelly comes to me, who I'd worked for at IOC in Quantico, and he walks through the door, and I looked up, and I said, hey, sir, what's up? Because Kelly's a funny guy, another Boston guy, but Kelly's got a great sense of humor. And, I always enjoyed seeing and talking to him. And I said, what's up, sir? And he goes, I want to talk to you. And then I think I did something wrong. I said, everything okay? He said, yeah, I got another job for you. I said, what's that? And he said, it's staff sec for the CG here in the division.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, sir, I don't even know what that is. And it sounds, and you know, I said, it sounds kind of gay. He said, Mac, look, it's a better job than this. I said, well, who do I work for? He said, well, you work for the CG, me, and you work right next to Joe Dunford, and you'll work next to him every day. And that's when I said, who's Joe Dunford? And he says, are you stupid? And I said, no, I just got here. I don't know who he is. He's the chief of staff, Mac. And so, but I'll tell you what, you talk about an interesting, to be able to sit in meetings every day, with General Mattis, General Kelly, and Colonel Dunford, and to watch the brain power, in those meetings and the weight of the issues that you were tackling. And then just the way they went about it was one of the great experiences, leadership experiences of my life. And
oh yeah, yeah.
Staff.
Well, I can understand, and I'll equate to what you just said. Let's go back in Vietnam when I'm a captain, battery commander, and I went to a couple operational planning meetings up on Firebase Dick, and when Colonel Barrel, Robert Barrel, soon to be a commandant. Had the 9th Marines, General Ray Davis, Medal of Honor, had the division, and Dick Stillwell, 3-star Stillwell, at 24th Corps. And to be in the same tent when they had sticks in their hand and were drawn in the sand about how we were going to run Operation Dewey Canyon down through the Ashaw Valley, I'll never forget that.
It's like being in the midst of dinosaurs. I mean, the men you speak of are in the pantheon of heroes. In the Marine Corps, they're bigger than big.
Yeah, yeah. And they're the ones that brought us along. That's the reason we always say, that's the thing behind the footsteps at Parris Island. When you get off the bus, you put your feet in these footsteps. These are the footsteps that other Marines are going before you, put their feet in. So you better stay a step with the beat of the drum. And so I've always said I try to put my feet in the footsteps of people like Barrow and Davis and Stillwell, and then I hope young guys that come behind me try to put their feet in the steps that Barnum left.
You know, sir, one of the things that I remember thinking when I first got to Iraq was, you know, you see people get killed and you contemplate your own mortality, and then quickly you see that, you know, I don't have a whole lot of control over whatever happens. The only thing I can control is what I do, how I lead, how I do my job. And that flag raising at Iwo Jima, that statue that casts a long shadow in terms of, I think, what you feel when you go. I think the first time you're involved in a conflict and you think, you know what, I'm not going to fail the Marines that have come before me. I'm a member of that long line, and I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I can tell you what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to fail the people that depend on me. And that tradition is huge.
There's a statue in the exploits of Iwo Jima. I'm sure they still do, but when I had a battalion at Parris Island, the drill instructors talked about Iwo Jima before these guys went to sleep at night, you know. They use that as the focal point of what's expected of you when you become a Marine.
There's a whole series of current events that I want to ask you about. You ready?
Mm.
There are Marine current events. Very high profile trial going on, or court martial going on at Camp Lejeune, that deals with incidents at Parris Island. Is this simply an ongoing fight, and on occasion we stumble? Is there any trick to it? Have we changed things and therefore we're not as good at it as we used to be? You've served down there. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's funny. I just had a long talk with General Mick Traynor today. Mick Traynor was the Assistant Depot Commander when I was there, and we talked about this very same thing. And I got to say, this stuff didn't happen on our watch. I mean, supervision is paramount, and I think when we talked last, you talked about Jarvis Lynch.
Yes.
This stuff would have never happened when Jarvis Lynch was down there, because he was always out and around and looking. This stuff didn't happen when I was there. I think it's supervision. I really do. And holding people's feet to the fire and making them follow the SOP and breaking this macho, I'm a drill instructor, I can do anything. It's just another damn Marine with another job to do.
You know what? You're not the first person I've heard say that, but there is something intoxicating about that campaign cover when it gets put on somebody's hat. Is the balance to that simply that presence and that supervision?
Well, I think, it's just like a team of thoroughbred horses that you're driving. You know, you got to let them run a little, but you also got to keep reins on them. And
right. And
that drill instructor's hat does not give you carte blanche authority to do it your way. You do it in keeping with the standard operating procedures, and that are proven. And as I used to say to drill instructors, if you've got a cuss to get a recruit to do something, then you're lowering yourself to his level. I mean, that's not leadership. That's authoritative leadership. I believe in persuasive leadership. And I think persuasive leadership over the 242 years has probably got a hell of a lot more done than authoritative type leadership.
What's the key to persuasive leadership?
Doing the right thing at the right time for the right reason, making other people do the right thing at the right time for the right reason, and set your standards. Everyone knows it. When people that you're in charge of vary from standards, you call them to task. And sometimes it's an ass-chewing, sometimes it's just a guidance session, and sometimes it's disciplinary. And you got to judge, where the problems fall. But people have just disciplined. Personal discipline is very important. If you can't discipline yourself, you can't discipline others, and you can't lead others. So I that's what I think. As I said, there's no one any that all our rank and everything else is secondary to the Eagle Global Anchor.
My guess.
And think about this. The Eagle Globe and Lanker on our uniforms, officer and enlisted alike, is above rank, above ribbons, and above shooting badges, and any other gadgets that you wear on your chest. So the Eagle Globe and Lanker is above all. And as far as I'm concerned, drill instructors who violate the SOP or vary from standard are letting down those that have gone before them in 240 some odd years of our glorious history. So I just I have no I place for it. I'm concerned, and I think it's senior NCO leadership, sergeant majors and first sergeants, and colonels and lieutenant colonels and captains and majors. They got to get out, and they got to be watching.
My guest is retired Marine colonel. His name is Barney Barnum. We're talking about the current events in the Marine Corps. Another thing that's been in the news and in the Department of the Navy is the collisions that the Navy has had. I finished over the weekend the reports that came out relative to both the collision of the Fitzgerald and the McCain. Have you watched that? Have you paid attention to that? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I've read some, and I've got to tell you, again, I think it's going to prove that our training. One of the things they brought out is the cutting back on the crews, and people are working harder and not getting enough sleep. That may lend to inattention and complacency, but that's a reason, but not an excuse. And I think that again, it's leadership. It's leadership. You've got to ride them hard and put them away wet, and let them know what's got to be done. And aboard ship, there's one way to do it, the right way. Because if you don't do it the right way, then people are going to get hurt, and or you're not going to accomplish the mission. So, lackadaisical anything. When I go aboard ship, I can tell within minutes how the discipline of that ship's going to be, just by the cleanliness, just by how the crew looks you in the eye rather than looking down at the deck, just looking at their uniforms. So I've been on ships that I'm sure that if they were in that same situation, probably had the same damn problem. So it all boils down to leadership and being firm, fair with your people, but be demanding. And, this is a tough business we're in. I mean, this is a war fighting. I mean, you got to be on edge, 24/7. And you're riding a warship. And the people that are out there know it's a warship. So you got to be prepared to execute what it's designed to do. And if it's lackadaisical or for some reason the skipper or the XO or the trainer officer doesn't make people do things and check them off. So I don't know. I just I'm a little concerned about my Navy, and I think what we've read so far, I think the CNO has admitted just what I just said.
So one of the things that's interesting is I heard that the CNO testified maybe 6 weeks ago about the incidents, and a lot of the things he couldn't answer because the investigations were pending, and he said those details will come out, and I will come back and testify again. But this whole 100-hour, work week, when you're deployed, that's 14 hours a day. That's 10 hours of free time. When you're at sea, if you
have... What else are you going
to
do?
And so to me, it's like this notion that that's a lot of work. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm sure it wasn't in Vietnam. It's sunrise to sunset and then some, and then up in the middle of the night if you got to be that too. But when you're deployed, there's nothing else to do. And I started asking friends, I said, is that too much? And they're like, no, you're at sea. What else are you going to do? Lay in the rack and watch movies? You work.
Yeah.
And so,
I think that, you got to get your rest. As I said, chow, eating chow, physical training, sleeping, and working. There's no liberty call. Else you're gonna go?
It's Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day, right? That's what we call it. You're aboard ship. It's the same.
But as I said, people do have to get their sleep. We go on I can remember going on exercises and people staying up for 24 hours. When I ran an exercise in Korea many years ago, ran it on a clock. And we started at 8 o'clock the first morning. And at 10 o'clock that night, we stopped. Everyone went to bed. And got up the next morning and started, and it was 10:01 or 22:01. And then we went another 10, 12 hours, and I stopped the clock, and everyone got sleep. And we got up, and it was more productive exercise than we stayed up for three straight days. You can't stay up for three straight days.
But they, they tried, and the worst offenders were the opsos. They'd have drip drooling down their chin. They'd have with coffee, and they'd be blithering idiots.
You know that, and what's it prove? I do have concerns, and I think the stuff I've read in the Navy Times, or the Marine Corps Times, whatever they call it now. It's indicated initially that what I just talked about is probably, that's going to be in the reports.
Roger.
But they said that's a reason. That's sure not a damn excuse.
No, when you
think, and then I understand they didn't even have the damn transponders on.
You know, a lot of them transit without those transponders on, but they can see everybody else. But
in a straight like that when you've got foreign ships.
Right. No, I know, depending on the ship. And the other thing is, with the McCain, every time that I transited through the Moluccan Straits, we were at general quarters. There wasn't people. And to think that you're going to collide with another ship, and you don't even hit the collision alarm or general quarters 60 seconds before you know it's going to happen. And if that happens, right, those guys would not have been killed in their rocks.
That's right. Well, it's tough to be a Monday morning quarterback because we weren't on the bridge, but I just, having spent as much time riding ships and being on bridges and watching the supervision and the oversight of the leadership, something was lacking, okay? And it wasn't just Murphy being on the bridge.
Right. No, I think we all share that concern about the Navy, but I think the one thing we all feel good about is you have the right guy in charge of the Department of Defense, the right guy in charge as a chairman that are gonna I think be able to address those issues, and I think return the Navy to its warfighting heritage, because it's got an incredible heritage. And I read a very interesting interview by a retired surface warfare captain, and he said, look, their navigation qualifications, not done. Their bridge watch standard qualifications, not done. He said, but I bet you that their sexual harassment training was all done. He said, I bet you their sexual assault training was all done.
He said,
Secretary Mavis, and I don't want to bash, Secretary Mavis, maybe a little bit, but he said, you get what you put emphasis on. And if that's your emphasis, he said, look, we can see, we've had four incidents here in the 7th Fleet in the space of 8 months. And he said, that's wrong. That's unacceptable. So, interesting. Let me switch gears with you. I had somebody send me an email after the first interview you did. And they said, essentially, Mac, when you introduced Colonel Barner at one point, you said Medal of Honor was awarded the Medal of Honor, and he corrected you. The next time you have him on, could you ask him to explain? I understand the word recipient is a better term. How, when we refer to people who win awards for valor, what is the appropriate way to address that?
No, I took exception to the word win. You don't win the medal. You go out to win ball games and trophies, and so a lot of the older Medal of Honor recipients take exception to the word, using the word win. You're a recipient or an awardee, but you're not a winner. You are a winner in life because of your accomplishments, but it's semantics. I don't make a big deal. It's like people call it the Congressional Medal of Honor. Well, it's not the Congressional Medal of Honor. It's the Medal of Honor. It happens to be, if you look at the awards chart, it's the Medal of Honor. But people call it the Congressional Medal of Honor because it's approved by the Congress and awarded by the President. So it's a man. It ain't a big deal. You know, I've never seen anybody do things that were wrong that I didn't correct them.
I had another person email me the following question, and it was, what has been the best part of being part of that group, that Medal of Honor Society?
Oh, just the ability to be with those who have experienced so much and done so much, and, you know, we're one big family. I mean, I just spent a weekend up in Ohio at the Patriots Ball with seven other recipients, and just to be with them and their families, it's just dynamite. It's just, they're an elite group, and as I said, it's the biggest fraternity, I mean, it's the greatest fraternity next to the Marine Corps that I know of, and they're all warriors, and they're all grateful Americans, so just great to be with them.
Another question I got for you was from somebody who had fought in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And the question read like this. Could you ask him how they deal with surviving the most improbable events in combat? Do they wrestle with the randomness why other guys who were with them were killed and why they weren't? The probability of surviving what they engaged in was so small, yet they survived. Is that an issue for some guys?
Well, I think we all pause and reflect on that, but I don't dwell on it because it could eat into you. Because, you know, you do feel bad when you lose people. I mean, right. the people that I lost who executed movements that I directed and were not successful, but if they hadn't done what they did, we might not have eventually come together. So you sort of rationalize a little bit that you have to do what needs to be done to save as many Marines and corpsmen as you can, and still accomplish mission. I mean, the mission drives everything.
Right.
So the mission has to drive everything, because if you worry about, oh, they're going to get someone hurt if they do this, you're going to be unsuccessful and probably get more people hurt. So, as I said, it's a tough business to be in, and that's the responsibility that comes with authority of command. And so if you're going to accept command, you've got to understand that you're going to have to make the tough calls sometimes. And they're not all black and white. Most of them are in the gray areas. And those are the tough ones, and because there's no training that prepares you for that. I don't think it's either, you know, the black or white areas.
Right.
Yeah, there's training for that because it's either against the rules and regulations and policies, or it's with them. But the gray areas is where you have to make the decision, and I just pray to God that you make the right decision. That was, you know, everybody says, did you have fear? Were you scared? Well, I says, well, anybody's not scared when they're getting shot at is full of shit. Or smoking dope. But the fear is that I would make the right decisions, and that my decisions would lend to mission accomplishment and get less people hurt. So that was my biggest concern. But after the battles, yeah, you do. When I go down to the wall, you know the hardest thing for me at the wall?
No.
Is looking at it. The sun is right and seeing my reflection. And I have my finger on Joe Murphy's name. Captain Gormley's name, Paul Gormley. And why them and not me? I mean, you can't help but not think about that. But you can't dwell on it, or it'll drive you in the ground like a dense snake. You can't do that.
I want to switch gears with you now. Did you watch the Ken Burns series, The Vietnam War?
I watched the first two and was very disappointed. And I have... talk to others who have watched it all, and it wasn't a documentary, it was a special. It didn't document the Vietnam War as it was planned and executed and fought. I was disappointed in the people that were interviewed. was all negative, and not too many hard-charging warriors. I understand from when I've read portions of it, you know, the protesters and being the baby killers and the Jane Fonda portions of it. Yeah, those things happened, but that wasn't the meat of the thing. And I was disappointed that they didn't interview more warriors that believed in why we were there. We want to help a country that asked for our help to try to stop the domino theory of communism, stop communism there. And just think of this. The Tet Offensive, and they didn't even mention John Ripley at the bridge. Give me a break. So I'm disappointed in the way it was, from what I saw, the two that I saw, and then I was traveling, so I didn't get to see the others. But in the meantime, I've since talked to a lot of guys who watched it all, and I've read their responses, guys that I fought with and think very highly of, and I concur with what they their analysis of it. So I just thought there was too much negativism rather than the positive aspects. You know, we might have got our nose bloody a few times, but we never lost a battle, and we weren't baby killers. Did we have a couple instances when people screwed up? Sure. And they
I would tell you, sir, that, and this is just me, they didn't make a big deal about me lie, which surprised me. I thought, you know, that it would occupy a more prominent place there. Ted, obviously.
So that was the biggest lack of leadership, Callie. That was deplorable. The whole world knew that was deplorable. But that was an incident.
Roger.
You know, one of millions of conflict, the firefights and battles that went on over there. And the highlight, I don't know. I just, as I said, typical Hollywood and sensationalism. That's enough said.
Do you mind if we talk about Milai? Because I watched a bunch of
I don't know. All I know is that it happened, and I never followed it, never read much about it. I guess I heard much about it afterwards, but I guess I was too busy doing other things.
I was talking to one of the company commanders at Quezon, and in the course of the conversation, he said to me, "Mac, do you know much about Milai?" And I thought, I said, well, I know the kind of the basics. And then after we got done, have you ever had a moment where you look at yourself and you're like, I don't really know that much about that, and kind of embarrassing. I should know something. I should know more about it. So I started reading and watching interviews about it, and so I got to tell you, I was completely blown away. My assumption was that these guys had been in country for a long time. And they had been bloodied a lot. And then when I heard that they weren't, I thought, how does this happen?
About it is the trial.
Right.
You know, I remember hearing all that, and it just pissing me off.
You know, and so what I did was I should have called you, but I didn't. I started interviewing Marines, and I said, well, tell me about your leadership experience. Was Vietnam so different? I mean, it was unique. In and of itself, like every war is unique, but what we see a lot of the Vietnam narrative is that civilians were killed on a regular basis, and it seems like the narrative is most of the time deliberately, drugs were plentiful, and rape was just a thing that got shrugged off, and so
well, I got to tell you, I was up north,
right,
and I've got to tell you. There wasn't a big drug problem at all. I remember a few times guys coming back from R&R and I could smell marijuana. So I remember getting together one day and I said, okay, I smell marijuana in this hill. Okay, first of all, it's illegal. Number two, we're artillerymen. You can't be on marijuana and get in the gun pit and level the bubbles and screw it up and the round's going to go in the wrong place. So here's a can be outside my hooch. I want to see all the marijuana come on. Well, there was nothing in there no more. Got them all together again. And I got to, you know, read my lips. And the next night, there wasn't any. So the next day, fall in, collected every cigarette on the firebase, burned them all, except those were in cartons, and I put people's names on them, and they went in the gunny sooch, and put the smoking lamp was out. No smoking. And I'll never forget, about 6 weeks into that, J.D. McDonald from Arkansas come up to me and says, "Skipper, I sure wish you'd lift this smoking ban." He says, "I feel so guilty sneaking cigarettes on you." And anyway, so finally I did lift the smoking ban. But I want to tell you, there was no more marijuana come on my firebase.
Well, you know, it was interesting. Every Marine, and again, Vietnam, very different depending on what year you were and where you were located.
Yeah.
You know, when you say up north, one of the things I did learn watching the documentary, I didn't know that much about Con Tien. Holy smokes. Wow. I mean, I, you know, I started reading about that afterwards. What a fight. What a brawl up there, you know, just south of the DMZ. And, but every Marine that came on, officer enlisted, said, you know, and one of the things that surprised me was that they were anxious to talk about Milan. I thought I'd rather not. Every one of them said, and General Lynch came back on, to talk mm-hmm. about it. Carl Marlanis came back on and talked about it. And all these guys said, look, you know, I asked Marlanis about the rape thing. He said, how could you rape somebody? You're on patrol. You're trying not to get killed. I mean, how could you even think about that? He said, so I've never understood that, and it was never a part of what we did. He said, most of my contact, though, happened to be against the NVA. He said, in terms of killing civilians, he said, no, we didn't do that. We didn't. The civilians we ran into most of the time were scared out of their minds, and were trying to get away from not only us, but the NVA, and trying to steer clear of the VC. And he said, yeah. So this narrative, this false narrative about Vietnam, he said, is one of the things that really, I think, among we Vietnam veterans, is really one of the things that bothers us, because, you know, we've all been painted with that Cali brush. And he said, it's wrong. It was an anomaly. And there might have been those incidents, very seldom, like there are in all wars, where you have weak leadership. But our Marines were no different than Marines of any other generation. When they're go ahead.
I tell you, back in some of those movies that came out, I went to a couple of them. I walked out. I mean, there wasn't anybody on my fire bases wearing bandanas and the language. I'm not a prude, but I tell you, there's no need for F this, F that, F this, F that. And it wasn't on my firebase. I just disrespect to officers and flagging. I don't want to talk about another service, but it wasn't Marine Corps. And a lot of that was guys in the rear with the gear who were bored, had nothing to do, and I'm sure there was a lot of drugs but those of us up north in I Corps were at war 24/7. I mean, there wasn't much slack time. So I guess guys went on R&R. My fire base was a good example. Guys, but they thought they learned real quick. They wanted to get away with it on my fire base. And I think my battalion in the rear, I know my first sergeant, but I'll tell you right now, he ran a tough ship back there while we were in the field. So, things do happen, you know, but again, it boils down to leadership and it's all leadership. I mean, all those problems can boil down if you let them get away. It's like let a kid put the hand in a cookie jar and you don't grab a hold of them, they're going to continue to put their hand in a cookie jar. Same with haircuts. Hell, I was the barber, me and the gunny on the firebase, and boy, everyone started cutting their own hair within their gun pit because they didn't want me or the gunny to cut it. You know, hygiene, flat jackets, helmets, stand two at 1700 at night before night. You know, I had Jack Kelly, God rest his soul, at a company on Firebase Cunningham, and he had me over one night, and then he says, "Oh, we got to go." "Why is that?" He says, "Well, stand to. It's 1700. Put your flat jacket and helmet on. Come with me." And he walked around and checked everybody and asked some questions and had their gear. So I went back to Tola Cunningham. I said, "We're going to have stand to in the better area." And so the first night, I'm going to tell you, we had stand to. We had guys that couldn't find their flak jacket, couldn't find their helmet, couldn't find their rifle. Well, after about four nights of stand to, everyone squared away and everything else. 7 days later, we got hit by a sapper attack. My troops never pissed a moan about stand to again.
You know, there's those universal axioms in the Marine Corps, and one of them is expect what you inspect. And I remember getting called into Lieutenant Colonel Bob Neller's office when I was one of his company commanders, and he looked at me and goes, "Why are your maintenance numbers so high?" And I said, "Because I inspect every Friday." And he looked at me. He said, "What do you do?" He said, "Because I want the other guys, the other company commanders, to do what you do." Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, I inspect something out of their weekly, daily, or monthly PM, and they know what they're supposed to have done. And I also it's a light armored, you know, infantry unit. So I said the scouts, the Marines, it's their 782 gear that gets laid out, mm-hmm. rifle inspection." If you and I start inspection at 9 o'clock, it's normally done by noon. I secure the company at 1300. If you fail, the first sergeant reinspects with me in overwatch at 1700. And trust me, you don't want to be there. And mm-hmm. and he looked at me and he said, "That's it." And I said, "That's it, sir. It's not that hard, but I inspect. I get under the vehicles. I get in the vehicles. I look at stuff. I look at batteries." And they know that. And you know what? Marines are easy. They'll do it. But you just got to be, you know, you got to be consistent, like raising children. And you got to get off your ass, and you got to inspect. And if you'll inspect, they'll give you anything you want. And he looked at me and goes, he said, "Quit lecturing me." He said, "That's it?" He said, "You got to be kidding me." He said, "All right, get out of here right now." But I mean, I agree with you. I mean, and thank God. I mean, could you imagine if you would have said? I remember hearing General Zinni tell a story about he flew in to be a company commander with his with a lieutenant, and the lieutenant went down to a platoon that happened to be in his company, meets the platoon sergeant, says, "I want to look at rifles tomorrow." And the platoon sergeant said, "Lieutenant, you know, this is Vietnam. We clean our own. This is not boot camp." And he says, "I still want to look at them." He said, so he made sure he was in the area of the inspection when he did it. And he said, after the third rifle, he looks at the platoon sergeant, and he said, "I thought you told me that they kept them clean here." And the platoon sergeant said, "I didn't know it was going to be some kind of boot camp inspection." And the lieutenant looked at him and said, "You get these things clean. I'll be back in 3 hours, and we'll do this again." And he said, you know, he was not prior enlisted. You know, he had uncommon leadership capability, because a lot of guys back down when they hear the word combat. The things we know to be tried and true, you know, somehow would get left by the wayside. Had you done that as a battery commander, I mean, God only knows what would have happened the night when this happened.
You know what? The biggest killer on the battlefield is complacency.
Right.
And I've always said, they're not supposed to do things, but if they're you don't demand them and make them do it, they're not going to do it. They're kids. They're young, you know, they're youngsters. And it doesn't take long before they'll know what's expected of them, because and if your leadership is good and you watch out for your troops, then they don't want to let you down. You know, it takes a while to get to that level. But when your troops say, "No, we better not do that, because the old man's gonna be disappointed."
Right.
So.
No, that's when you've arrived, yes, sir. When you hear them call you the old man, or you've proven to them that if we all took off our rank, I'd still be in charge of this thing. And that's really, I think, that's the proof of a leader.
Yeah. So I think when a lot of young officers will say, "You know, when I get into a new unit, what should I do?" I says the right things. Get in there and rifles inspections, hygiene, you know, the things that Marines, General Chapman used to say, there's things Marines should be doing and things Marines should not be doing. And so you got to make sure they're doing what they should be doing. Simple as that. That's leadership.
I want to ask you a question about hazing. A lot of discussion in the Marine Corps about hazing. And I think that things, whether you call them rites of initiation, which I tended to enjoy, can all of a sudden become hazing. When you're doing the shellback ceremony, there's a difference between crawling through the garbage and being forced to eat it. Your thoughts on hazing in the Marine Corps?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm a chef. I crossed the equator, so I've been through that. I've been to, in the old days, many Navy Chiefs initiations. But the only thing with hazing or initiations or carrying on traditions is there's a line you can't cross. And there's got to be someone that's got the moxie to say to everybody, okay, that's it. That's the end of it. Because you're into the point of someone's going to get hurt or demeaning, and it loses the purpose. And that's the same way as, fraternities. It starts out doing this and that, and they've done it for 100 years in the fraternity house, but then they all get drunk, and then they push it too far over the edge, and someone gets hurt or killed. So the whole thing is, I believe in traditions. There's got to be someone standing back watching it all, knowing that there's a time to say, okay, that's it, stop. Yeah, we've had our traditions. You can say that you've crossed the rites of passage, and I had nothing against people tacking on chevrons and stuff,
right.
but let it stop there. Again, leadership.
Is hazing a problem or a symptom of a problem? So were you?
I would say, well, first of all, hazing. There's no place for hazing. I know that they told me about hazing when he was going to be a Lance Corporal, the corporal, and then the corporals. And I'm sure there's some of that going on in units. I don't know. Someone's just got to be watching it to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. Hazing can't be demeaning. If you got to have a rites of passage when you break into the staff and CO mess or something, I don't know. I haven't given it much thought, but the only thing is, some units do certain things one way and a certain way another, but the whole thing is, it can't be demeaning and it cannot, injured in any way or be detrimental to mission accomplishment.
My guest, for a few more minutes is a retired Marine Corps colonel. He's an artilleryman. He is the recipient of the Medal of Honor and certainly a proud Marine. I have an interesting question that I've asked, and I'll ask you. In your opinion, sir, give me, when you think of the greatest leaders in the Marine Corps, who comes to mind? Only one person, when you talk about great leaders, who comes to mind? And in terms of the combat history of the Marine Corps, in your opinion, the finest combat moment of the Marine Corps?
Oh, that's, well, I would imagine it's during the island campaigns of World War II. Probably Howland Mad Smith's, it's hard to say, because it all depends on how much of you've read or people have talked about. You know, I was aide to General Lew Walt through Navy Crosses, Tarawa, worked with General Ray Davis, as a division commander after he earned his Medal of Honor, and of course, being in the presence of and being commanded by Colonel Bob Barrow. You know, it's just hard to say. And I'm glad you said in combat rather than leaders, because of, you know, so many people. You don't have to be a great general officer and a great leader to be in combat. I mean, you know, preparing to go and training and running the corps and doing that stuff. But I just, you know, I read General Turnage. I got to know General Turnage well, and how much everybody respected him as a leader in combat, and General Wall. And it's tough to say. That's a tough one. I'm going to tell you, that's a tough one.
Come on, this is a tough program. How about these are just opinion questions. How about a finest combat moment in Marine Corps history? I would tell you, my opinion, and the way I answered it, the greatest Marine leader that I've ever seen, and I caveat that with that I've ever seen is Tony Zinni. I think he was just an incredible Marine leader. And then when he's done, you know, he continues that leadership for the nation, as a special envoy to the Middle East. And then I would even say that even his descent, I would say in particular, his descent relative to the war in Iraq. To me, that's an example of a leader that you know, stands up and is accountable to his country. And so that was my answer. And then the finest moment, there's so many you could name, but if I were to pick one, I would say the Chosin Reservoir. And first of all, the fight of the 5th and 7th Marines to get back to the division. And unbelievable.
That one, in that battle, I would say probably Bill Barber and Hector Caporetta.
Oh, my, unbelievable. You read it, and it's like, this can't be true. This is fiction. Oh, yeah. Somebody's making this up.
Yeah. That battle, Fox Hill, I'll tell you, that was unbelievable. But we thank God in our glorious Corps we had so many great leaders. And of course, I knew Tony Zinni back when we were captains. He was a captain. I was a major at Camp Lejeune, and I never got to serve, you know, with him in combat, but sure follows his exploits and what he has done. No, you're right. He's just a Marine's Marine.
The Marine's
and,
Marine.
I served with and was the military secretary to General Al Gray. So, you know, I believe in the way things that he has done for our Corps.
Right. Wow.
And, when you start talking about commandants, if you look back over the histories, we seem to have the right guy for the right time. It just sort of happens. And, of course, I'm a Bob Nella fan. Bob was an Iron Major working for me when I was Colonel at SPD.
Really?
So, yep.
He was an SPC. He was a tactics instructor at the basic school when I was a lieutenant. He was my battalion commander as a company commander, and then and we've remained friends, and we've served together in Iraq. And I want to ask you a question, and this is another email I got. The period in the 70s, and you can help me with this and clarify this. Who was the commandant that said, "I don't care if there's only me and my driver left when this is done"?
General Barrow.
That was General Barrow.
General Barrow says, we'll go down to 4 Marines. Me, my driver, the sergeant major, and I don't know who else, but anyways. And I was in the 2nd Division, and we were putting 20 and 30 guys out a day. I was the staff secretary. And General Joslin and Sam Jaskilka had the division at the time. And, Colonel Jim Marsh and Cal Colleen were the chiefs of staff, and I know we put a lot because every one of those books went across my desk. General Barrow said, "No, I'll go down to fire team."
And so what was the criteria? Could you paint a picture? Was it drugs? Was it racism?
It was drugs and racial. And when you have drugs and racial, then you have disrespect for authority. Camp Lejeune. I was there, let's see, 72, 3, 4, 5, in that time frame.
Right.
And I got to tell you, I was always out, I was a Battalion 3, XO, and then acting CO of 210. I would check the barracks 3 or 4 times a week. When I checked the barracks, I had a baseball bat in one hand and my black Labrador on the leash in the other. I didn't have any trouble. I remember one Friday afternoon there at the Swoop Circle.
Wow.
That there was such a racial clash that the fire trucks had to come with fire hoses and break it up. I mean, can you imagine that? Does that make you sick as a Marine to see other Marines doing that?
It's hard to imagine, to be honest with you.
It was just unbelievable. But I want to tell you, General Barrow cleaned up our corps.
Not a surprise to you, though. You had seen
Not at all. Not at all.
No, I think I've related this to you before, but General Lynch, when I had him on, talked to me about LZ Margo, when they took the battalion into this, and I don't know if it was part of Dewey Canyon or not, but he said
it wasn't.
It had been registered by NVA artillery. Unbeknownst to us, we go in there, and once we got in there, they hammered us. And he said we had 160-something casualties that day. And we just started medevacking guys out. And he said, and then late in the day, here comes a Huey, and off jumps Colonel Barrow. What do you need for
that?
And when
it was during, I don't know what the time frame was, but I don't recall that name.
Well, he got
who was General? Who was a Colonel or General Lynch with at that time? You know,
I can't remember.
The battalion?
I can't remember.
The Ninth Marines?
I believe it was Ninth.
Well, it would have been if General Barrow got off.
Yep. And then, but he got emotional when he talked about, you know, here this guy gets out, and he said, and he said, Mac, I have to tell you, he said these were iron men. They were not afraid. You know, and he wanted to know what he could do to help me. And I told him, sir, we're getting our final guys out of here, and then we'll be ready to go. And he looked at me, he said, they're going to pay for this, just so you know. We're going to go get them. And then he said, the following morning, another Huey comes in. It was General Davis. And he said, he went down to meet him. The helicopter, you know, landed on a road and then took off, and Davis is walking up, and he says, General, I don't think it's safe for you to be here. And he said, General Davis looked at him and he said, son, this is my AO. I'll go wherever the hell I want to.
Well, that's General Davis.
And he said it was just such an intoxicating experience being around men like that who you know, yeah, okay, they bloodied our nose, you know, but we're going to get them. We're going to go get them, and it's going to start right now. And he said it was just the most incredible experience. So I want to ask you, when I saw you on TV at the White House recently.
Yep.
And as a recipient of the Medal of Honor, do you get invited to all those ceremonies?
Yes, of course. I'm local.
Okay.
And I live in Northern Virginia, so I'm easy to get to. Yeah, I go to the White House for Medal of Honor ceremonies. I didn't go during the Obama administration. I went to a couple, but I felt uneasy. But anyway, no, it's quite an honor to be there. So I've been to the last two or three from Trump.
And
I got to tell you, the latest two are Army medics from
right.
Vietnam.
Right.
And I want to tell you their stories are absolutely phenomenal. And they're just great guys.
Really?
Just guys. Yeah. So I'm glad that they got upgraded.
Is that what it was for all these years? That's one of the things I didn't understand is where were these stories all these years? Are they in somebody's desk?
The latest award was a classified mission.
Okay.
And but it's finally been unclassified and it broke it loose. And then the others are, you know, paperwork gets lost. And a guy gets a, you know, I think the last two, both of them are under the review. Remember where Congress, we reviewed and there's been a number of upgrades and both of them were included in those upgrades, yeah.
Got it.
But there's a lot of reasons and some of the paperwork gets lost or someone, everyone's unit thinks that this guy got, is going to get the Medal of Honor, but he was wounded and evacuated. Then they were wounded and evacuated. And then, of course, other people got wounded and evacuated. Who's around to give statements? You know? I mean, things like that happen. And so there's a lot of guys, there's not a lot, but I'm sure there's a number that should have received awards who didn't. Only because they were never put in for it, because in the fog of war, the people who would have been writing all the statements or recommending were either wounded or killed. So that's a sad state. But
now, final question. I'll let you go, sir. And first of all, our guest is retired Marine Colonel Barney Barnum. He's an artilleryman by trade, and. If you want, I would just, for everybody listening to this, go into the All Marine Radio Archives and listen to the first interview where Colonel Barnum talks about going to Vietnam to get a little bit of experience as a first lieutenant, if I'm not mistaken, and then the actions that led to him becoming a recipient of the Medal of Honor, and then. It's very humorous, the discussion he has with General Walt about, going, what General Walt said that, you know, you stick with me for a year and I'll let you go anywhere you want to go. And, could you relay that story one more time, sir?
I was, the aide to, General Lew Walt when he was, Deputy Chief of Staff of Manpower. And he said, Barnum, if you can last a year with me as an aide, I'll get you, you can go any place you want in the Marine Corps. But he says, you know, age don't last a year with me. Well, then he became assistant commandant, and I moved down to front office with him. And 12 months go by, and I go in at 13 months, and I said, General, you know, time for orders, you know. I says, you said if I could, I can go any place I want if I don't last it 12 months, and I spend 13 months. He says, all right, where do you want to go? I said, I want to go back to Vietnam. You can't go to Vietnam. You have the Medal of Honor. I said, General, you said if I lasted 12 months, and I lasted 13 that you would, you know, and we had a long discussion. And, he did what generals do and they lived up to the word. And I went back and I became a battery commander of Echo Battery, 2nd Battalion, 12th Marines.
I love
that. Same battery I was a forward observer in the first time.
Oh, I didn't know that. I love that story.
Oh, yeah. Yep, same battery.
I love that story. So first of all, I want to thank you for taking time out of your day and doing this. I know that you have a pretty hefty schedule traveling and whatnot. And thank you very much for doing this. Always appreciate.
Well, you caught me home. And for the Marines on board, I want to extend my best wishes and on our as we celebrate the founding of our glorious Corps 242 years ago. So happy birthday, Marines, and God bless you and God bless America.
That is Colonel Barney Barnum. More. Of All Marine Radio coming up next. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled machine anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.